for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Long before organic produce became available at the local supermarket, Wendell Berry was farming and writing with the purity of food in mind. Berry often works the land on his family farm in Kentucky with horses, and he often writes his books by hand, using natural light so as not to waste electricity. Berry has just published his first book of poems in 5 years. It's titled Leavings. It's a blend of elegies, lyrics, and letters with the occasional short love poem. His recent book of essays, titled Bringing It to the Table, is now out in paperback. Wendell Berry joins me in the studio. I look forward to hearing your calls, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. What a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much.
And
likewise,
thank you for being here.
Pleasure to meet you.
The title of this book of poetry, Leavings, what did you intend to convey with that title?
Well, it's a book to be left behind, for one thing, but a book is made of leaves, and it raises the question always of what you would like to leave behind in the way of leaves.
Read us, if you would, that poem on page 40.
I know that I am getting old, and I say so. But I don't think of myself as an old man. I think of myself as a young man with unforeseen debilities. Time is neither young nor old, but simply new, always counting, the only apocalypse. And the clouds, no mere measure of or geometry, no cubism can account for clouds or satisfactorily for bodies. There is no science for this or art either. Even the old body is new. Who has known it before? And no sooner new than gone, to be replaced by a body yet older and again new. The clouds are rarely absent from our sky over this humid valley, and there is a sycamore that I watch as growing on the river bank, it forecloses the horizon like the years of an old man. And you, who are as old almost as I am, I love as I loved you young, except that old, I am astonished at such a possibility and am duly grateful.
I love that poem.
Thank you.
How long have you and your wife been together?
We have been married since 1957.
So 52
2 years.
My husband and I will celebrate our 50th this year.
Well, congratulations.
And congratulations to you.
Thank you.
It is interesting to me that as you speak of yourself, saying I am getting old, but I don't think of myself as an old man, how do you think of yourself?
Well, being young is very habit-forming, I think. So my life these days is full of surprises that I don't have the spring and agility that I used to have, or the endurance or the swiftness. And but that is an interesting state of things to accommodate to. And I've followed my own aging with a good deal of interest because it's put me in touch in a way that nothing else ever could have with my forebears, my grandparents and my parents. So I think of them now with more sympathy than ever before.
How old did they all live to?
They all lived to be pretty old, in their 80s. My father and mother were about 90 when they died.
May I ask how old you are now?
I'm 75.
You look like a very young 75 to me.
Well, I think I'm supposed to thank you when you say that. Thank you very much.
Are you continuing to work the farm?
Yes. It isn't as elaborate an operation as it once was, and I'm not as speedy or durable at it as I used to be, but yes. And I'm very grateful. It's a very marginal farm, I need to say. It never has provided a living for us, but it provides fascination and responsibilities that require me to be outdoors a considerable part of every day. And for that, I'm grateful.
In the beginning, when you and your wife began to work the farm, did you think it would provide you with a living?
No, I had no illusions about that. I was teaching at a university for a living, but I needed that connection to farming, which I'd had from birth, and I wanted, as I say, some reason to work outdoors every day. And we wanted that economic connection to our place. We wanted a place to put our children to work when they were young. So there were lots of reasons for that. It's a part-time farm that seems to be a full-time concern.
A full-time connection to the earth, clearly.
Yes.
That is something that's truly in your blood.
Yes, yes. My parents and grandparents were country people, and I was very carefully raised by my father and to some extent by his father to think of myself as a land steward. And to learn farming as a discipline and an art. In my upbringing, I never heard the phrase, just a farmer.
It must sadden you to see the number of family farms declining.
Yes, that is a great sadness. And it's been going on a long time, and I've been witness to it for most of my life and motivated by it for most of my life. But there is a compensating new thing that's happening, and that is the growth of farmers' markets and community-supported agriculture farms. That are where these things are happening, they are restoring diversity to the agricultural landscapes and enforcing a propriety of scale that commercial agriculture hasn't required.
How worried are you about the growth of commercial farming and so-called agribusiness?
Well, I'm plenty worried about it. I'm as worried about it as I can be because typically agribusiness has performed in the way industry always has performed, that is, providing a series of solutions meant to solve one problem each. And this is the way you get soil erosion, too much specialization, high toxicity, and these results are becoming undeniable. The hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico for example, is only one of maybe hundreds.
Explain that hypoxic zone.
Well, I'm not a scientist enough to explain it well, but it comes from nitrogen runoff from the farmlands of the Mississippi drainage, and it causes overgrowth of algae, which uses up the oxygen in the water, which of course kills the life of this zone. So the industrialization of agriculture has proceeded pretty largely without respect to context. It comes as a surprise to discover that the Gulf of Mexico is part of the context of agriculture in the Midwest.
And, of course, you on your small farm are particularly concerned about what goes into the soil and how that soil is tended, which apparently is a perhaps diminishing art.
Well, it is an art greatly diminished because good farming depends on competent local knowledge.
Wendell Berry, his new book of poetry, the first in 5 years, is titled Leavings. His other book, now in paperback, called Bringing It to the Table. We have two messages from Facebook for Wendell Berry. One, Christy says, Wendell Berry has been food for my soul over more years than I can remember. I can't think of anything to ask him, but do tell him thank you for me. Then Joe says, please ask Wendell Berry what he makes of climate change. The parallels between our two programs today is great. I'd love to hear him talk about how individuals and societies should or can respond to global warming.
Well, that's a large question, and I could quickly speak beyond my competence about it. Since I'm not a climate scientist of any kind, I have simply to decide whether to take those warnings about climate change seriously, and I do take them seriously. I would like to add, however, that if climate change were not a consideration, we would still be wasting too much, spoiling too much, and polluting too much. Even if we weren't worried about climate change, it would be wrong to pollute the air to the extent that trees have a hard time living, for instance, because trees we have to look upon as fellow members of our places. And if they're having a hard time living, then we have to take that as a warning to ourselves.
A warning to do what as an individual?
To revert to our longest and most honored understanding of ourselves as human beings, to thrift and generosity and temperance and compassion and forgiveness, those things. And if we try to revive in ourselves an understanding and appreciation of that old honored definition, then we'll understand how we must do in our practical life and how we must carry it on without respect for official instructions and without waiting for official permissions.
You know, we are constantly described these days as a consumer society. Given that people like yourself would perhaps consider yourself outside that domain, is it possible that those hearing your words might think more about how they are living their lives?
Well, the answer to that previous question, of course, begins with self-criticism. And useful criticism always begins with an appropriate standard. And consumerism, the flourishing of consumerism, is not an adequate standard, just as economic feasibility is not an adequate standard for human behavior. So what we have to understand is that the economy is based, first of all, upon the natural world, and second of all, upon the economic landscapes and those who use them to provide us with the necessities of our lives. Last of all, should it be dependent upon consumerism. But our present economy is based upon consumerism. And when we speak of stimulating the economy, we don't mean greater care for the natural world or greater concern for the economic landscapes or the farmers and foresters who use them. We speak of stimulating spending. And as I've said in a recent essay, spending is not an economic virtue. Miserliness is not an economic virtue either, but saving is. Thrift is. Because for one thing, thrift and saving, conservatism in the proper true sense, means that you can be generous.
Are you and your wife among those who would call themselves vegetarians for precisely these reasons?
No, we're not. We have rough land in a rolling landscape that's highly vulnerable to erosion. And if it is going to be productive, it has to be made productive by grazing animals. And so we have among our enterprises a small sheep flock, and we do eat meat. Because diversity is a part of the definition of good farming, plants and animals, and as great a diversity as possible of each. So we think that the presence of animals in agriculture is a part of health. We do oppose factory farming with animals. Our goal is to see a more decentralized, more humane, system of animal agriculture that would put the animals outdoors on pasture where they belong.
In one of the essays in your book, Bringing It to the Table on Farming and Food, you describe the manner in which some creatures are held on large farms, barely able to move, barely able to have any sort of existence except to feed before they're slaughtered.
Yes. Well, this is horrible cruelty for the animals, and it is the worst possible working conditions for the people who tend those places. Those places depend on annual grain production, which is a threat to the land by way of erosion and pollutants. And that kind of farming converts those feeds into pollutants of air and water. So it's a bad thing any way you look at it, and it is indefensible, except on the familiar grounds of industrial efficiency and economic feasibility, which, as I've already said, are bad standards.
And that is a standard on which many Americans make their choices, especially in these hard times where you are suggesting that people turn to smaller farms to know where their food is coming from, to have a greater connection with that food. You object to the widespread use of the words that imply that one food is better than another simply because of how it's been raised.
How it's been raised, of course, has something to do with the quality of food, just as how they're raised has something to do with the quality of people.
Of course.
But I would add to what you were saying, I'd like to see people make more use of their dooryards in cities. One of the problems is that good food has so far tended to be more expensive than bad food, and that's a problem that needs to be addressed. It's a complicated problem because, overall, food is too cheap. We've had a cheap food policy with the goal of making it cheap at great expense to the land and the people of the land. So it's a complicated problem, and what one wishes for is real discourse, real conversation on the subject of food and land and our ways of agricultural production.
And to that extent, I would assume you would rejoice in Michelle Obama's efforts to create a White House garden, to bring in young children so that they begin to have an understanding of where the food comes from and how to tend it well.
I did, with my friends Wes Jackson and Fred Kirschenman, visit the White House garden in, I think it was July, and probably that's the most significant tiny plot of ground in the United States at this moment, because it offers a kind of permission from the first family to other families to look upon their dooryards as possibly productive of food.
And indeed, there are some who've written books who are talking about using public spaces in which to grow food.
Well, in fact, that's been going on for quite a while, and it's another significant and hope-giving movement. The use of vacant lots and otherwise wasted places in cities as places to grow communal gardens, often people with tiny little plots of their own among other tiny plots that are cultivated by other people.
I live in an area where there are public gardens, about 35 acres of those public gardens, where people have their small plots. They share the abundance of what they grow. It's really wonderful to see. And if we could see more of that, I'm sure it would benefit everyone.
Well, it's not a negligible thing that these gardens contribute to the beauty and interest of urban life, as well as the health of the gardeners, by exercise and by eating well.
Wendell Berry, he has a brand new book of poetry. It's titled Leavings, the first book he's written in 5 years. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Would you be good enough to read for us? I think it's the poem on page 95.
Poem, do not raise your voice. Be a whisper that says there, where the stream speaks to itself of the deep rock of the hill it has carved its way down to in flowing over them. There, where the sun enters and the tanager flares suddenly on the lighted branch. There, where the aerial columbine brightens on its slender stalk. Walk, poem, watch, and make no noise.
That's such an internal thought, that the poem should make no noise. Tell me what you mean.
Well, you know, there's the poetry, I think, has benefited in our time from the growth of public reading on the part of the poets themselves. And this has increased the consciousness of poems as patterns of sounds and even as writings to be read aloud. This poem I've just read aloud over the radio, a little oddly for the poem it is. But it speaks contrary to that public impulse of poetry as an impulse toward quietness, solitude, watchfulness, and meditation on the world around us.
How much time do you spend in quietude and meditation each day?
Well, it would be hard to say. The quiet time I spend each day is usually spent at work writing. But then I do, for reasons of the farm, take walks to check the fences and so on. And sometimes I just take walks just to be in places I know well and have loved increasingly for many years.
Are you thinking of ideas for poetry as you walk?
Well, I'm not trying to. My agreement with the muse is that if she leaves me alone, I'll leave her alone. But if poems come to me as I grow quiet and walk and look, then I accept an obligation to do as good a job as I can of writing them.
Does that mean you carry with you a little notepad?
Yes, ma'am.
That's
a little notepad.
Uh-huh.
That's the kind of technology I love. Also, of course, a pencil.
A pencil, and if a word or a thought or a leaf or a stem come into mind, you go from there.
Well, you have to. It has to come to mind as words, and it has to come to mind as words that have, I would say, a musical quality, a rhythmical or a lyrical impulse that seems to be potent with yet more that hasn't come yet.
So you're talking more about a group of words than a single word.
Yes, you're talking about an art of putting things together. And if there's no promise that the things in your mind will ever come together, then you'd better be still.
Wendell Berry, his new book of poetry is titled Leavings. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The war in Vietnam keeps on a raging.
Music from the defiant final season opener of the Smothers Brothers Show. In the late 60s, they challenged the censors at CBS and the political establishment. They lost their show, but later won a court battle. On the next Fresh Air, David Bianculli talks about his new book, Dangerously Funny, the uncensored story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Join us.
No problem, but we're still here. That we
Welcome back to my conversation with Wendell Berry. He has a new book of poetry out. It's titled Leavings. He's also in paperback brought out an earlier book of essays titled Bringing It to the Table on Farming and Food. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Jennifer, who's in Zeeland, Michigan. Good morning to you, Jennifer. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Good morning, Wendell Berry.
Good morning.
I am so excited. It is such an honor to hear your voice and to talk to you. My heart's just been racing and have a chance to talk to you. My husband and I live in Zeeland, and we have a whole shelf full of your books. And I was telling the woman who took my call, your books are a treasure in our home. We love the books and the stories. And I'm looking at two books. One is Fidelity that was printed in 92, and the other was Jaber Crow. My husband just finished Jaber Crow. We love the stories. And our sons, my two sons are 7 and 8. They are adopted, and their middle names, one is Wendell and the other is Barry. That's their middle names.
How lovely.
My youngest son's name is Athy, and his name is right from Jaber Crow. There's a character in the book. So Athy Berry. I don't know if we're saying it the way you would have said it, the name Athey, but that's his name. And we've been meaning for years to send a photograph to your address or to get something just to show you these beautiful boys that, we named Wendell Berry, their middle name. So I just wanted a chance to tell you thank you for all of your stories. I've passed stories on to my friends and my family and my mom, and they're beautiful.
That's
beautiful.
Great, well, Jennifer.
Thank you. I guess I could call your children by name without snapping my fingers.
I guess you could. And, you know, if you would like to send photographs of your children to Wendell Berry, you might do it through Counterpoint Press. That is the publisher of his new book of poems titled Leavings. Thanks for calling. And here's an email from Kristen, who says she's writing from Indianapolis. How has your commitment to stewarding the earth and living according to natural light affected other aspects of your life, like your art and relationships within a community?
I'd better say in a hurry that though I do without some modern conveniences, I don't do without them entirely, and I'm just as implicated in things I dislike as everybody else. I'm too petroleum dependent, too coal dependent, too automobile dependent, and so on. I think that by foregoing some of these so-called conveniences, I've simply convinced myself in the best way that I don't need them, that they can be dispensed with, that saying no to the advertisers and the persuaders is a possibility. And I would go further if I could.
But on that very point, would you read for us your poem on page 7?
Well, this is a poem written with a kind of pleasure. It's called Look It Over. I leave behind even my walking stick. My knife is in my pocket, but that I have forgot. I bring no car, no cell phone, no computer, no camera, no CD player, no fax, no TV, not even a book. I go into the woods. I sit on a log provided at no cost. It is the earth I've come to, the earth itself, sadly abused by the stupidity only humans are capable of, but as ever, itself. Free, a bargain, get it while it lasts.
And we do hope it lasts. Let's go now to Apex, North Carolina. Good morning, Sheila. You're on the air. Go right ahead. Sheila, are you there? Nope, I guess she's not. Let's go instead to Scott in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi there.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm a big fan of Mr. Berry's. I think he's one of the important writers of our time, and I'm really glad you have him on the air today, Diane. There's two ideas that you've talked about in your writings in the past, Mr. Berry, that I've always wanted to hear you talk a little more about. One is what would be considered a defense of tobacco farming. I'm not sure that you put it that way, but I think you know what I mean. And the other is, in one of your books about race, you talk about how Southern Christian preachers emphasized salvation by grace over salvation by works because of the mixed-race congregation. It was the only way they could preach to the slave owners. And I wondered if you'd just talk a little bit more about those two ideas. I think they're really interesting and provocative.
Well, that's an invitation to do a lot of talking. To begin with, I have never defended in my writings tobacco use or tobacco farming per se. And I have never, for myself, grown a crop of tobacco, though I've worked all my life with my neighbors in their crops. All that I have defended was what was the tobacco program, which was a program that came out of the New Deal, and it combined production controls with price supports. It was, as it developed, a no-net cost program. That is, it cost the public nothing. And it was an exemplary program, except that it bears the stigma of tobacco. I did defend the program because I thought that if tobacco was going to be grown, I would like to see the small farmers of the tobacco states continue to produce it. Now the program has been destroyed. My vocation as a defender of the program is at an end, and I can only point out now that the crop is grown in huge acreages, requiring a lot of technology and complete dependence on migrant workers, and it is highly vulnerable to abuse by the companies. The growers no longer have a way of defending themselves.
On the question of race?
The question of race. And I that got tangled up in theology in a way that I'm incapable of managing. I'm not much of a theologian. It was a fact that Christian people carried on slavery, and even that they had biblical rationalizations for slavery. And this seems to be something that we've outgrown within limits. We still exploit labor. We still exploit the people who actually do the work, from woodland and farm owners down to the migrant workers, who are nearly exclusively responsible for doing the work that feeds us. We exploit people who do manual labor, which we look down upon, as we always have. So the issue of slavery and work and the rationalizations continues to be, I think, a complicated issue. If we don't make slaves of people by as chattels or as property, we make wage slaves of them if we can, both domestically in the agricultural economy and overseas in sweatshop situations and so on. In other words, the aim of our economy has always been to drive down the cost of production, and to do that, we replace people with machines, and we've underpaid them and overworked them. Maybe I just ought to quit on that question. It gets more complicated the longer you talk. I would just like to say that it is an enormously complicated issue.
Scott, I'm glad you called. Would you read for us the poem on page 14, titled Questionnaire?
Now, this is a poem written as a public statement. It consists of a list of five questions. Questionnaire. 1. How much poison are you willing to eat for the success of the free market and global trade? Please name your preferred poisons. 2. For the sake of goodness, how much evil are you willing to do? Fill in the following blanks with the names of your favorite evils and acts of hatred. 3. What sacrifices are you prepared to make for culture and civilization? Please list the monuments, shrines, and works of art you would most willingly destroy. 4. In the name of patriotism and the flag, how much of our beloved land are you willing to desecrate? List in the following spaces the mountains, rivers, towns, farms you could most readily do without. 5. State briefly the ideas, ideals, or hopes, the energy sources, the kinds of security for which you would kill a child. Name, please, the children whom you would be willing to kill.
Wendell Berry, reading from his new book of poems. It's titled Leavings. The poem you've just heard is titled Questionnaire. We've been talking about food. We've been talking about the air we breathe, the soil we grow things in. What about the mountaintops, the taking of mountaintops for development of coal?
Well, I come from one of the states that has the misfortune to be known as a coal state. And in the Appalachian coal fields, the coal companies have developed a method of coal mining called mountaintop removal or mountain removal, by means of which they simply shove everything that isn't coal off the top of the coal into the nearby stream valleys, hollows, and scoop the coal out, and then they do something called reclamation, which means they smooth out the ugly results and sow alien species such as Serrecia lespediza. This is done in utter contempt for the natural world, the given world, what some people call the creation. And there could be no more eloquent demonstration of the less than no value we place upon the little skim of topsoil that takes thousands of years to develop and upon which we depend utterly for our life. It is also done in perfect contempt for the local population whose water supply is ruined, whose wells are destroyed, whose houses are damaged, and who are sometimes killed by rocks rolling off the mining site.
We have an email. Deb writes, my favorite poem of Mr. Berry's, if I can possibly choose one, is The Peace of Wild Things. It begins, when despair for the world grows in me. Can Mr. Berry talk about how the earth and the natural world give him hope despite the daunting realities that confront us daily?
Well, the what we call the natural world gives hope by its ability to take a lot of abuse and continue to live and renew its life year after year. It also gives hope because it is in many ways consolingly beautiful. And I suppose, just like to point out that its economic worth is inseparable from its beauty and its meaning to us.
Wendell Berry, his new book of poems is titled Leavings. Also, his book Bringing It to the Table, Essays on Farming and Food, is now out in paperback. What a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me. Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.